Good morning. And you are listening to WMFO in Medford. That's WMFO Medford. And we're about to switch it up to from Earbuddies to Socialist Radio. Changing our name a little bit from Socialist Alternative Radio to Socialist Radio. And we are here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And we are talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And running a little late today, so we're going to throw on some music. Probably should let that song play out, but I wanted to get the top of the hour in here. And today we're going to be talking a lot about international events with the election results coming in from Britain. The mass protests are still happening in many countries around the world, from Chile to Lebanon to others. And we're going to catch our breath from running up the stairs. We really appreciate our regular listeners. And if you're new, again, this is Socialist Radio. Please introduce yourself. Wrong. Oh, no, there's only one mic up. Hold on. Well, we're going to do this music real quick, and we'll be right back to fix that technical problem.
Sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on the point from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry Arm, woman liberationist, and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
So we're going to go back and redo our introductions?
Yeah. Oh, there you go.
Diego's back. Introduce yourself, please, Diego.
Diego. D-I-E-G-O. Not bingo. Diego.
Hey, did you bring any music?
Yes.
Yay. Let's put that on. See if it works. So anyway, to our regular listeners that are just tuning in, we're running a little behind schedule here. So we're going to have to take care of some technical things, difficulties we've been having. But for new listeners, you just tuned into some unique programming on your FM dial.
So you changed the name,
dial.
Huh?
Well, no, not officially. But we'll talk about that some other time because it's okay. Complicated. But yeah, so we are known as Socialist Alternative Radio. If you go to WMFO.org, a good way to listen to our station, you'll see us listed as Socialist Alternative Radio. We're going to appeal for a name change to just Socialist Radio. And
sorry.
I'm going to start referring to us as that. Hope no one minds. And you can go to your dial, your radio dial, if you're in the area. If you're near Tufts, if you're near Medford, if you're near in Somerville or Medford, if you're on the highway just north of Somerville or Medford. And today with the wind, who knows where the signal's going.
Well, now with all the buildings and stuff. You
That's true. The buildings get in the way.
Signals now. Yeah.
No, I haven't. No, it's been okay when I've checked in, but maybe you're right.
You're on the highway. I'm talking about in the city. As you're in the city, it's not...
Not good.
You can be... One day I was listening to the radio at the mall.
Yep.
I had to go outside, then I can hear it. But it was in the mall, I couldn't hear it.
Well, Cambridge mall you're talking about.
Yeah.
That's far away. That's not bad. For this signal, I mean. Anyway, you can try 91.5 FM. WMFO, also known as Tufts Free Forum, commercial free, community based radio. We're a little slice of that community based, like we said earlier, talking music from a working class, democratic socialist perspective. That is socialist radio. And we're here every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And today, I don't know, is everyone out there feeling the rush? But the holidays, you know, you got to get all this stuff done, especially if you have kids. And it's like a shorter season or something. I can't figure it out because Thanksgiving was late or something. National Mourning Day, if you will.
I'm not a big holiday guy.
And yeah, well, I like the time off, and I like, you know, trying to make the kids happy, which is impossible. But anyway,
the only thing I like is spending time with my mother, and that's it.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, spending time with family. People are kind of reinventing the holidays, I think, for the better. And so I don't know, this year, right? Things are really rushed, including to this weekend. I just completely miscalculated this weekend. My son had some stuff at school, and my daughter that we had to deal with on Friday and Saturday, oddly. And well, some Saturdays are like that anyway. And we haven't even gone grocery shopping. We're down to, we only have one working car. We really need, we try to get by with like a good car and a bad car, but even bad cars cost a lot of money. Ton of money, especially with repairs and insurance. So we had to ditch that a while ago, and we're down to one car. So if you're out doing something, the other person can't be doing it and do something different, you know. Anyway, blah blah blah, long story short, no groceries. House is running, we're running out of food, and rushing around, just rushing around like crazy. How you doing?
Oh my god.
As you were saying on the way in, Evo Morales has you depressed.
I'm gonna
riff on that.
You ever watch All in the Family?
I've seen it, yeah.
Okay, so Edith goes, how was your day? And he turns around, look at my face. You know?
How was your day, Archie?
He was more working class than right winger, I think, without him realizing.
In real life, he was liberal, Carol O'Connor.
Yeah, no, yeah. I meant, you know,
in
the character. The character. Even though he was a right winger, he really was.
Every
he
once
said
in a while.
Lot of left wing things, like, whoa.
Every
Archie,
once in a while.
You're the pinko.
Yeah, every once in a while, they tried to show a class. Thing going on because
like,
man, that show
like
came
there was
out.
One, there was one episode where there was a strike, and he's like, it's called edumacation, you know? They crossed the line, that's it, you know? They're getting it.
Yeah.
Just like, whoa, Archie, what happened to your conservative views?
There? Yeah, yeah.
So I was kind of.
Yeah, you're right. I agree with that.
I was kind of happy. Oh, yeah, at least he knew you don't cross that picket line. You knew that.
Unfortunately, though, the guy that created the show and had a lot of influence, Norman Lear, I don't know. He became a millionaire and he's like straight up liberal, and that's bad. And if you want to know why on this show, we try to stick to the real definitions of conservative and liberal. Both political philosophies, even in the United States. are real. But they're pro-capitalist. They're both pro-capitalist. A liberal, unless they're misusing the term, they usually think that they can just tweak capitalism a little bit of regulation here,
Keynesian,
a little bit of this there.
Is that the Keynesian?
That would
types?
Be the most liberal, the Keynesians. Yeah,
trickle down. Economics.
They want to tax the working class more. They want to get the government to cough up more money for social programs, but they're very unclear on how far that should go. You know, because in societies where social democrats have gained some power, the liberals, you know, where they've gotten some good social benefits, the liberals are very easily convinced it's too much, quote unquote, and they turn on it, you know, viciously. And a lot of countries where there is a legitimate a mass workers' party, or has been historically in recent history, they were formed specifically to combat both liberalism and conservatism. Like the British Labour Party, for example, back when it started, was a socialist party. It's not anymore, but it was a socialist party. Still has elements of socialism in it. But what existed in Britain around the turn of the 20th century was conservatives on the one hand, liberals on the other, and that was killing the working people. And it was a huge British colonial empire still happening. So. In terms of basic capitalism, in terms of imperialism, meaning war for capitalism, a war machine for capitalism, neocolonialism, liberals are all on board to one extent or another. You know, that's part of our critique of Sanders. A lot of people say Sanders is a socialist. He is not a socialist. His goal, his view of socialism is a liberal view. He says his socialist heroes are FDR, Lyndon Johnson, believe it or not, and JFK.
Whoa.
Take a 2-second look at any of those regimes, including FDR. It was completely propped up by Jim Crow in the South. It was an incredibly racist regime. Different standards for, you know, not allowing black workers to get a lot of social benefits. And when social benefits were allowed, they would have two-tier systems, you know.
Like north, clauses, south. A lot of clauses.
Yeah, yeah. But mostly it was the fact that Democrats completely controlled the South. And that was a big voting block for the northern liberal. Well, they were both liberals, but the northern Democrats. See, I fall into the trap too. But so you know, and you look
so
at FDR.
Dixiecrats and the liberals up north went hand in hand,
Well, the Dixiecrats were liberals in the true sense of the word. But yeah, yes, exactly. If you want to use that term, absolutely. And they relied on each other tremendously. And FDR never tried to, you know, overturn. And he never led a civil rights movement. Democrats never lead any movements, actually, something you should keep in mind when you have it with your illusions in Sanders that many people have now. He says there should be a mass movement. You should have a mass movement. Or he'll say, I'm leading a big movement. But what he means by that is electoral movement, like for him. Like if you look at Our Revolution, the group that has a front group, it's about voting for Sanders, endorsing other liberals. And raising money. I get mail from them all the time.
I got text by someone named Rebecca.
Yeah, no, I get
saying,
that.
Saying, vote for blah, 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 because he's anti-corruption, anti-this, anti...
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, he's not anti-imperialism or anti-capitalist, and that's the definition. That's where a socialist definition starts. Is you're anti-capitalist, you want to see a change to a socialist economy, socialist society, and you want to see, and you don't believe in supporting the market, increasing market share through war, which is basically imperialism in a nutshell. So you don't support the war machine of capitalist countries. And you are critical of those two things, obviously, very, very critical. Sanders is supporting the F-35 billions of dollars of military equipment in one little jet that they can use nuclear weapons with, by the way. Yeah. That's right in his home state of Vermont, and he's supporting that in general. The other day, though, last week, he came out. He said, "You know, the military budget's too big." Most of the Democrats voted for that. I don't know if he did or not. He criticized it, but it's hypocritical because he supported other military budgets and he supports the F-35. So, you know, just mentioning Sanders as an example, we could easily take Warren or any of the rest of them. And when it comes to U.S. imperialism, when it comes to war spending, they might be critical of the amount. Some of them vote for more and more all the time. But they're not, I'm talking about liberal Democrats, but they are not critical of the concept. And they're not critical of, like, if Sanders got the cuts he wanted, that would still leave an obscene amount of money in the military budget, more than they ever need.
I mean, how much weapons do you need?
Well, the answer should be zero, and I don't mean that in an idealistic way. I just mean if you look at the tensions between nations and the fact and the existence of nations, that's all the doing of the capitalists to a great extent. You know, they solidified nation states and created borders that are a lot, in most places, a lot more formal and more difficult to cross than ever before, despite the Eurozone and all that stuff. And they create nationalist tensions because despite all this talk about liberals like this talk about, you know, and this is actually goes back to the 1800s even, as you know Marxists and including Marx himself talked about the tendency for the concentration of capital to always emerge and reemerge under capitalism. Another way to put that is a tendency towards monopolization and monopolies. So some socialists or so-called socialists in Germany tried to create a whole theory. I think it was Edward Bernstein, a whole theory about how, well, now that there's the capitalists are turning into monopolies, that makes it easier to control them and easier transition to socialism and all that. Completely wrong. And Lenin answered that, for example. There were many answers to that, but one of them was Lenin writing in a book called Imperialism in 1916 or 1914, I can't remember which, saying, no, look, that just puts capitalist competition at a higher, more dangerous level, not at an easier, more controllable level. And things like wars and economic recessions and depressions will always shake up the monopolies, but then they'll tend to reemerge again. And not all of them.
The concentration of
very monopolized. Look at Apple, Google.
Was it a few now? It used to be five. Now it's probably down to three. Viacom, all those
control the
media,
corporate media. Absolutely, yep. Yeah. That's a great example.
You got Google, yeah. Facebook.
Yeah. Well, and also in oil, ExxonMobil. Yeah. So you have Amazon. You have these huge monopolies, and unlike the theory that it makes capitalism tamer, it makes it more vicious on a higher, more dangerous scale. And so a monopoly like Amazon, just look at it like anecdotally, like from your own life, you can see this like greedy monster growing and growing and growing, and it's never enough. And people say that. People say, why is it never enough for the capitalists? Why is it never enough? Why can't they be satisfied with their billions that they can never spend now? Because it's not about individuals. It's about a system. It's about power, yeah. It's about the system also. That's true. That's a great point. About power and competition with other capitalists, that keeps driving them into deeper and deeper levels of greed. But also, you're absolutely right, that's a big thing. But it's also about how they, an institution where everything from the laws of incorporation, the way they're written, to what we're talking about from the power standpoint, competition and everything, and return on shares and so on, they to survive. As capitalists, they have to make ever-increasing amounts of profit and money, or they will be taken over by another capitalist, or they'll be bought out, you know, that kind of thing, various ways of being taken over, shoved out of a market, whatever, not being able to force funding or fund themselves a military that will increase their market share internationally, which is, again, back to imperialism like we're talking about. So, there is no end to it, actually. Jeff Bezos and Warren Buffett and Bill Gates will collect zillions of dollars, you know? At a certain point, Gates resigned, right? I don't think he even has Microsoft anymore because he has more than enough money to live 50 lives on, even in the opulent spending that he uses.
On his little island somewhere in Dubai.
But he keeps his hand in, you know? And he knows there's no limit. Capitalists will just destroy the planet as they try to outcompete each other and try to get more and more power. Like you said, economic power. And military power flows from that economic power and so on. But my original point was going to be that a lot of liberals like to say, well, with multinationals and like this guy Bernstein, the idea of a nation state is obsolete now because there's these corporations that hide, Apple was hiding in Ireland for a while. I think it was Apple. No, they're over in China. Who was it? There was some corporation that was basing itself largely in Ireland because they had weak tax laws on corporations, even weaker than here. But the bottom line is they if you think of a corporation, you can usually think of the country that it emanates from and that it has ties, the strongest ties to. And a lot of them are the United States because the United States is considered a safe haven, quote unquote, for investment because of the its military power is what 18 times its closest rival or something like that. If you looked at a chart, you could add up the next 14 or 18 countries and combine all their, this includes China, places like that, combine all their military spending, and the U.S. would outstrip all of
and
them.
There's more stability here.
That's what I mean, yeah.
It's not like you're going to invest in Central America, you think, but you, it's still, you know, there may be a war or something.
Right, but it's stability based on coercion, based on war footing, or the ability to conduct war, based on proxy wars, based on so-called small wars that are happening now, like in Afghanistan and so on. So,
and coup d'etats.
Yep. And so these countries, these corporations do fall back on a country, often the U.S., but sometimes other powerful countries, because they need that military club to exert their irrational economic system on people to make that stick and make that continue. You know, like the whole thing with the Eurozone that's been missing from any commentary I hear here, at least in terms of the corporate media, is that the essence of the Eurozone is the European Central Bank and the policies that it demands when it lends money or when it allows entry into the Eurozone. It's not like NAFTA, right? If you're going to be part of this trade agreement, you're going to have to privatize. You're going to have to cut social spending. You're going to have to accept loans at horrible terms. So it's like Syriza in Greece, left-wing government elected a bunch of 5 years ago now, something like that,
yep.
Named Syriza. It came from the real left-wing in Greece, so different groups getting together. And they claimed they were going to be really socialist, really left-wing. And immediately they got attacked really badly by austerity measures from the European Central Bank, basically saying, oh, the Greek economy is weak and we're going to make it weaker. So they placed all these demands on the economy. And Syriza said, no, we're not going to privatize. We're not going to destroy our education. We're not going to privatize our health care and all this other stuff. And they just kept pushing and said, well, if you don't do that, we're not giving you any more money. And the Greek economy is relatively small, by European standards, big economy by world standards, and not able to get itself out of that situation where it could be independent from the money it needed from the European Central Bank.
Totally different what Iceland did.
Under capitalism. Iceland went through some bad times, too, for the same reason. But Iceland's much smaller.
They were smart enough to pull out and say...
I've heard that, but I don't know what the conditions are like in Iceland.
That's like
so,
what happened in Poland lately, in a lot of Eastern European countries took out their gold.
Mm-hmm.
Because they was afraid that what happened to Venezuela is going to happen to them.
Yeah, it could get seized, right?
Yeah.
And well, Poland...
When Venezuela went and said, hey, we're going to... You know, they said... The England said no.
Yep. Well, Poland has the what? By the way, what was that number three? Poland has the as a right winger in there. Let me just finish that example of the left wing government, though. So a left wing government gets in power, like Syriza, a real left wing government, and we could talk about Morales later. Maybe it's the same deal with Morales, right? And they all this stuff, right? Like in Greece with Syriza, they even had a referendum. Remember that, where 61% of the people voted to reject the deal of the European Central Bank?
Yes.
Remember that?
2015.
All the austerity, yeah. So they had a mandate. They had supposedly the will. And then within a few days, literally after the mandate, they reversed course. Some of them resigned, but most of them stuck with it, the Syriza government, and said, we have no choice. And ever since then, they implemented. So you had the left all of a sudden implementing austerity. And you had, then the next election finally came up, and they lost.
They lost.
Of course, yeah. That was a right-wing government.
They probably have a good conservative government in Greece. Of those fascists in there.
I don't know. I don't know what's going on with Golden Dawn. I don't think they're as big as they used to be, but they weren't. I mean, they were never that big, but I think they've shrunk. But the point is, not only the loss of election, but to what that does to the conscience of the people when you see a left-wing government, which has happened many, many times under social democracy and in reformism in general. That's why socialists say no. Real socialists say you can't stop with reforms. You have to really change, fundamentally change the economy. And so everyone from Chavez to Morales, because Morales made deals with, I don't know if you know this, but he made deals with big corporations in recent years to come in and do their thing in Bolivia. That weakens, not strengthens, socialism. They go after the immediate money thinking they're going to maybe use it for good things, that this is the best case scenario, that maybe they're corrupt, I don't know. But really, that money always comes with strings attached. Always, always, always. And so those strings tighten, get tighter and tighter and tighter until there's some sort of breaking point, you know, to put it in a metaphor. Because, like, everyone's going to, we'll talk about this later, but everyone's wondering, you know, how did Corbyn lose, you know? And, well, Corbyn was a real left-winger, right? And the British Labour Party still has socialists like Corbyn in it. Corbyn is a real socialist, not like Sanders, and who is not a real socialist. And by the way, I'm not trashing Sanders personally or whatever. He's, you know, he's just a corporate politician, bottom line, and people were refusing to see that because he's labeled a socialist because when he was earlier, much earlier in his career in the 70s, you could say he was a socialist. But that changed in the 80s drastically and was clearly buried in the 90s and until now. So, Corbyn, though, really kept to supporting socialist policies, although he was part of supporting governments that, like under Blair and Kinnock and all that, that were right-wing Labour governments. And this is my point. They brought in austerity measures. People learned to not trust the Labour Party at all, right? Working people. This is not going to solve anything. So they go look. People go looking for some sort of shortcut, some sort of solution. There's a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment in Britain. There's a lot of legitimate, not necessarily anti-immigrant, but just legitimate, we don't like the European, you know, central bank and the Eurozone and all that. We don't want that. The liberals, including upper middle class liberals and rich liberals, they thought that was just a crazy notion. Thought that was insane. How could you be against the Eurozone? A lot of upper middle class youth, student youth, they mimicked that. They said, I love the Eurozone. I can go to another country and get a job. Not seeing what the austerity measures in Britain as part of the Eurozone austerity measures happening in France and other countries, which we'll talk about a little, they are making the average person suffer. So the average person lashes out, just like some people that voted for Trump here. It's wrong, right? But you can't convince them, and they're right, that life is going to be any better under Labour government or any better under Democrats here, not to conflate the two. They're very different. The Democratic Party is a corporate capitalist party. Labour Party is a party that has a history of socialism and sometimes puts forward socialist policies or gets yanked back into pro-capitalist policies. So under Corbyn's putting forward, at least rhetorically, socialist policies. But a lot of people here don't know. I'm starting to get into the British thing, too much detail, But a lot of people don't know.
I didn't notice.
Yeah. Well, here's a big fact that people should look into. If you're wondering why Corbyn lost, look at what the local labor governments did in cities around Britain in the last 3 or 4 years. Or let's just say even the last 2 years. They implemented austerity cuts, yeah.
They cut
social benefits, yeah. So if you're in that area, labor's not your friend. And that's what people don't get about the Democratic Party here. Again, I don't mean to make an exact analogy because they're different parties, but people with illusions in the Democrats and think, you know, liberals that I work with, for example, or rich people that I know, or fairly rich people, like upper middle class people, they're like, how could anyone not vote Democrat? You know, I have a picture in mind of a few people at work.
Did I tell you about the one?
Well, let me finish the thing real quick. But hold that thought. I'm sorry. But I just want to finish the thought real quick. So the reason that people don't vote Democrat all the time is because most big cities in this country are controlled by the Democrats. And they're the ones doing all the cuts and all the nastiness. About here in Massachusetts, we're about to get screwed over badly on things that are going to hurt anyone that drives, has to drive. There's probably going to be increased gas tax. It's already 24 cents a gallon, something like that. They're going to put new tolls up. They're going to do all this stuff to hurt people. The tax system is extremely unfair on workers. There's cuts happening all over the place. Prices going up. College is unaffordable. All this stuff happens in states and cities where you have Democrats controlling the show. And then they wonder why a state might switch. And this isn't to say Republicans are doing better. Republicans will probably do worse in a lot of cases. But bad is bad enough for people. They want an alternative, and there isn't one. Sorry, go ahead.
Like George Carlin said, they don't give a.
Yeah, they don't, you're not in their club.
No. Like the one.
What was that thing you were going to say?
One guy that was I worked at in Whole Foods at the time. What's his name? No, it wasn't Whole Foods. It was, who'd you vote for? I said Jill Stein. And he's like, it's because of you people that he got in.
Yeah.
Talk about Trump.
Yeah, yeah.
What? Really?
Factually untrue, but who cares? If it was true, it might have built an alternative, you know? Might have started to build an alternative party.
That's what I was telling him. I haven't been since.
Yeah, me too.
The 2000s.
Yeah. The hope, let's educate the liberals a little bit. If you run into someone that's a real socialist or real independent, and they're voting left, which is good. So they're voting for outside the box, outside the duopoly of the two corporate parties, and you're going to spit on them for that. They have a right to spit right back and say it's because of you, this ping pong game. You think Clinton was any better? You think Obama was any better? You think people's lives didn't go downhill in the 2007-2008 recession and the big bailout for the big banks and all that? What about Occupy? Why did that happen? You know? People are sick in this country of not having a choice. A lot of them don't vote, which I'm not defending that. I think you should try to find something you can vote for, or write in something. But another reason people vote for independent candidates is we're not stupid. We're voting for independent lefts because we want them to be part of a continuum. We want them to be part of an organizing project to get a workers' party of some
exactly,
sort going.
Committee.
Yeah.
I even went as far as to blow his mind and say, you know what, and I hope that one day if we organize right, we'll have a people's committee, like a Soviet, and no more presidents. That whole thing of president is like having a king.
Right, I agree. But even before you get to that point, there's a point where, look, enough people are voting for these independent socialist candidates or left greens or whatever, pop, you know, progressives outside the Democratic and Republican Party duopoly. If they're voting outside of that enough, it'll create the energy and the actual concrete resources to start
councils.
Building a workers' party.
For councils.
Well, I think that will come later. I think it would be
a process, but you know.
I think first it would be a workers' party of some sort.
And you can be recalled. Not
yeah,
even peace,
that's
recalled.
Important. But even a social
Social
Democratic Party would be a step forward in the U.S. And a lot of people like to say, oh, the Democratic Party is like a Social Democratic Party. It's totally not. It's got no membership. You can't be a member of the Democratic Party. All you can do is register to vote as a Democrat. It doesn't matter then how you vote. No one's tracking that. I mean, they track it, but they don't. It doesn't compel you to vote Democrat, right? And then you can get involved in groups that are around the Democratic Party made up of Democrats, but you can't actually be a member of the Democratic Party, per se. Unions don't have any formal membership or affiliation to the Democratic Party, even though unions dump a lot of my dues money and everyone else that's in the union dues money in the Democratic Party. It's a huge mistake. They could put that into a Labor Party, a Workers' Party. We'd have that tomorrow. So, no union affiliation, no union membership, no individual membership. What is the Democratic Party? It's an electoral machine. It's a voting machine. Social Democratic parties, on the other hand, the ones that still do this, I'm not sure they all do this anymore, do have memberships. Like the British Labor Party just got reinvigorated before the last before the last two elections, because they lost an election under this guy Ed Miliband ran, and they wanted to reinvigorate the party. And it might happen before he actually ran. I have to double check that. But around the time of his election, they said, we're going to open up the party to new members. All you got to do is pay £3 and send your name in. You can be a member. And what I don't think they did, I have to double check on this, I don't think they reinvigorated all the things that existed in the Labour Party before that for the membership. The membership of the Labour Party used to have neighborhood groups in big cities. They used to have local, regional, like, representation based on, you know, voting in that region, and then it would kick upwards, you know, to the national representatives.
In the 80s,
used to have,
right?
Yeah, in the 80s. Used to, and even before that. And used to have Labor Party Young Socialists, you know, a socialist group. Used to also have all these things in the Constitution, like Clause 4, that were socialist ideas or clauses in the Constitution of the British Labor Party. When they started to bring back the membership, I don't think they brought back, I know they didn't bring back all those things, but they started to talk about it at least, you know? Here, you cannot join the Democratic Party. All you can do is register to vote, and you can put down Democrat if you want to. It's not the same thing. The unions can't join the Democratic Party. They can't have a say on the DNC. They can't. Unless they're an individual union leader is so rich and maybe ran for office and won, then you might get on the DNC, maybe. But it's a very small group. DNC is actually, Democratic National Committee is actually a corporation. A lot of people don't know that.
This newspaper I was reading yesterday, sometimes they leave it at, you know,
yeah,
on the
Metro,
train.
Yeah, Metro, yeah.
I got, no, it was not Metro, something else.
Oh, really? Okay.
And I look back and it's just, Happy Holidays, Local 12, Plumbers and Gas something.
Oh, no.
And it says right there, the leaders and this person of business something secretary. I'm like, really, business? You got business right on that?
A lot of the building trades have
shame
business. They call them business agents, And some of them are leaders. Some of them that's less of a leadership position.
Associates or...
And but it's still up in the leadership. And yeah, it's horrible language. That comes from a whole history of everything from McCarthyism in the labor movement here to the there's business unionism is a thread of the labor movement in the U.S. Definitely still is. I work at Harvard University. I'm in the Clerical Workers Union. The leadership of that union is completely business unionist. They use different terminology than, say, Samuel Gompers did back, in the late 1800s, early 1900s. But it's the same thing. It's business unionist.
Do they come into your workplace and say, tighten your belts, kids?
Whenever they face any opposition like they do where I work, like people just ran against them for leadership. I used to run against them. I used to get elected as union rep when they'd run people against me. But I couldn't break into the executive board arena of the whole thing because the resources were just too big. You have to take off weeks. You have to have a little army behind you. They illegally use the apparatus of the union leadership, but they do it in a way that there's no paper trail. You can't prove it. So, for example, I had a roommate who knew that I didn't like the union leadership, that I was very pro-union but wanted a new leadership. And the head of the union, who wasn't even a worker, he was unelected. He's just the executive director of the union, which that
they don't want a two-split faction in their union.
They want to exist. No, it's worse than that. They have an authoritarian union structure where they've been in power since day one. They are representatives of themselves, and includes people that aren't elected even. And this guy one day crowned himself executive director of our union. He never was elected to anything. Never worked at Harvard.
Consent, nothing, not even
No. And so this executive director went up to my roommate working in an office somewhere and said, this guy, me, Jeff, he's this, and this. All of it was just slanders and lies and stuff like that. And she was mad about it because we got along and she told me about it. And I said, well, that's complete. That was him on us paying for that guy through our union dues who's in power campaigning for other people, the people that were in power at a lower level on the executive board. That's illegal according to the AFSCME Constitution. Would you go with me and we'll find a way to, testify against that? And she was afraid to. And I thought that fear was unreasonable, and I think it is unreasonable. But there is a way that in the Constitution where the whole thing is very circular. You complain about the election, and boom, it comes back to the people that are doing the bad things, or they're people like them, very close to them. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't kick up to some national arbitrator, as far as I remember. And maybe it does now, but it didn't then. And it just went to the person that's orchestrating the illegal activity to begin with. So
this one circle.
Yeah. So again, that's not an argument against unions because some unions are more democratic. A lot of unions are more democratic than my union. But my union has a progressive veneer. My union has a progressive veneer. But if you read closely their propaganda, we're partners with management. We believe in jointness with management. They agree when management says they're having money problems. They're having money problems. Blah, blah, yeah. And Harvard is not having money problems. That's a lie. So basically, they're into... That's a form of business unionism without the old rhetoric of a Samuel Gompers, same thing, though. And it hurts us. Our raises have been crap for, decades now. And they started out good because we had the energy of the union coming in, and Harvard was like, wow, this is kind of scary. This is a lot of people now that are in a union. They could really... do something. And we were, to get the union in, we had to have some rallies and stuff like that, But the minute they got in, they pulled back on all that stuff. They started to red bait people like me, and they got their wish 20 some odd years later, 30 years later, and they're still in power, the same people, unelected.
What about the dining services? They're more radical?
Yes, but that doesn't mean they're more democratic. I don't know the details of the internal life of that union anymore. I used to. So I don't know, but they're definitely doing more activity now. And in fact, there's a strike happening at Harvard of grad students.
Oh, I heard about that. Slam, right?
Yeah. Well, no, it's not Slam. Oh, okay. That's a student support group. There's a strike of Harvard graduate students right now at Harvard, which is great. And I hope they win and people should support them. They got their energy, they said, some of them say, the leadership, they got their energy from seeing the dining hall workers at Harvard about 2 or 3 years ago which we were on that picket line. They go, went out. Did you go on the picket line? Did you show up to that?
I did.
Yeah. So they
won. I also almost got hired there.
Oh, that's right. Damn.
Yeah, remember I got interviewed? I still have I passed the test and everything.
Yeah.
I just got to call her back. But I called her back and said, maybe I'm looking for a part-time, but then I was already got... See, this right. I got hired by the hospital, and then that came up, because it's so slow in calling you.
Harvard's like
that. All of a sudden, I'm like, okay, I'm hired at the hospital. Oh, we want to interview you. I was like, damn it. You know, so I went in there, and I said, listen, I've already got this set up, but, you know, I've already been there a year or so, and my schedule's pretty much, you know, steady.
Yeah.
So I can look for a second part-time.
Yeah.
So I might be doing that, but...
good luck. I hope you get it.
But so the way she said it was like when I got... When she was like, and by the way, it's union. And she said it like in a way like, yeah. I was like, that's great in my head.
Well, in
she said it like, I don't like union. So like, you know...
Yeah, I know, I know.
The whole impression like, and by the way, it's union. Like, you know, like that. I'm like, really? I'm like,
that's too bad.
In my head, I'm going, it is union.
Well, bottom line, it's always better to be in a union than not be in a union. Yeah. There's a chance the union could change. Fortunately, the union at Harvard that I'm in is so big that most people that are in the union don't vote. They have nothing to do. It sounds like the United States, right? It's a microcosm for the country. They don't vote. No, it's not their fault. There's no life to the union. There's no, like, they don't have the mass membership meetings. In fact, they got rid of having any meetings at all for a long time. I just saw they sent out this calendar, Cambridge membership meeting. It's the first time they've done it in years. But when they used to do it, they used to do this thing where they wouldn't tell, they wouldn't, like you're used to seeing someone from the union in your area, maybe. Some areas, there's
hospital?
No, I'm talking about where I work. Mm-hmm. One is used to seeing someone from the union once in a while, or there's a local union representative, like a shop steward, in some places, in most places. Whether they bother to do what I'm about to say or not, I don't know. But I do know that when it came to these meetings, they put them, they told the people that supported them who are, you know, in the areas, and they went around to the areas, and they didn't tell people about them. They just sent out a pro forma written notice. And then when you show up to the meetings, because when we first got in, the meetings were well attended, they did everything they could to stop voting. They created a quota of the membership that was so high, it was like you have to get like 700 people to a meeting to even have a vote on anything. And that's wrong. You should be able to, the way that people in a democratic union control the union themselves is they're, as members, they're allowed to vote and discuss and vote on important union business. And if you're worried about low quotas, you send out a notice saying, this meeting we talked about X, we're going to vote on it next meeting. You know what I mean? You have a newsletter that should go out to everybody. They have a newsletter in my union. It comes out maybe once every few years, very regularly, and the membership has no access to it. So I know from other unions that the newsletter is used for campaigners. If you're campaigning for office, they'll give you a quarter of a page, write your 300-word whatever you want, and everyone will see that just about in the union. And they don't have, by the way, a print newsletter. They just do electronic in this so-called union that I'm in. And no print edition, and it comes out irregularly, and nobody has access to it except for the unelected and elected leadership there. And when I say elected, they're always elected by a tiny minority in the union. And again, not because people are stupid or whatever, because they don't even know a lot of people that the union exists, except that the dues come out of their paycheck. Not every area is covered. And when it is, you get someone just coming around pretending to be your friend. Hi, how are you? How you doing? They have this conscious thing, and I know about this because I used to work closely with them before the union got in, and a little bit afterwards. They have a conscious thing where they believe in, what is it? How do they phrase it? Like sort of, I think I'm using the wrong terminology. You know, relationship. That's it. Relational or relationship building. Well, that happens organically in any union organization or anything you're organizing, socialist organizing. You get to know the people, some of the people at least, that you're organizing, and you build up a relationship with them of some sort. Here, they're very intentional about it to the point where it's very fake. It's almost like you're dealing with a robot or something. Say, oh, you meet the person, you schedule lunch with them, you be nice, you pretend you're their friend, and then you get them to support you. And unfortunately, it works a lot of the time. So some worker will be like, yeah, that's, she's really nice or he's really nice and I'm friends with them. Oh, really? Well, when's the last time you went out and, you know, did something or whatever? Maybe with a few, but it's like no real friendships. They just call them friendships And they're manipulating people psychologically and on a personal level. It's an emotional manipulation that I find abhorrent. Now, are there emotional ties in organizing? Absolutely. Though, but they develop organically. There's plenty of people that if I want to be a leader, or if I want to even run for leadership, I'm not going to be friends with everyone. I can't be. Mm-hmm. You know, I shouldn't be expected to be, and they shouldn't expect it, and they don't. Most people, someone that understands reality understands that.
Yeah, it's like work. You're not gonna be everyone's friend. And I hate this other one.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. So they take that and they use it. It doesn't always work, but it works a lot to get blind loyalty on policies that are hurting the membership. So, and it's really funny because I've talked to people that are like really like laid off. You know, and they're not getting their job back. And I said, well, you know, I say as politely as I can, say, this is why we were trying to become the new leaders in the union, because we wanted to get a no layoffs clause so you wouldn't be laid off and so on. And they, and I'd say really, really nicely, gently, so is anyone helping you from the unionship? And they'd be like, nah, they stopped. They stopped helping me. They're not doing anything for me. And they didn't do anything, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like thinking to myself, I told you so, but you can't say that. So I'm like, okay, well, but then they'll inevitably know. People aren't stupid. They'll know where I'm coming from, and they'll say, but she's they're that person's still really nice, and I really like them. I'm gonna give them a call, you know. So that kind of false friendship thing in union organizing can go a long way, if other things are happening. Like if you don't have union membership meetings, then nobody sees that there's other people putting forward alternative ideas. Oh, you mean we could go on strike like the dining hall workers? Oh, we could vote on things like the dining hall workers and other unions? Oh, we could do this? You know, we vote on our contract. It's the same thing. They rig the vote by having carefully select information. They don't tell people about concessions oftentimes. They tell people a one-sided view. They make the raises seem more than they're going to be, and they make it seem like if you don't accept this, you're going to go on strike. This is the last offer, and that's not true. People are always at Harvard, in my union, always voting on the first offer that they get. And there's no meetings going up to that to say, what should our demands be? Sometimes they do a survey, sometimes they don't, but the survey's online. Survey they create. Things I write in things that go beyond the survey, of course, you know, because they're just trying to, you know, narrowly go a certain way.
Yep.
And part of business unionism, which exists in a lot of unions in this country, is concessionary bargaining, meaning you go into a contract battle or to have a union recognized or to get a contract renewed, and you immediately think of concessions to give management. So that's like going into a battle saying, we're going to shoot 50 of our frontline soldiers and hopefully that other army will feel sorry for us. Makes no sense. Unions are committing suicide in this country. That's part of the weakness of unions, is they oftentimes commit suicide. Not the rank and file, not the members, but the leadership. If you're not a socialist, you're not a good union leader, number one. You have no vision for way forward for the working class. So you are basically engaged in concessionary bargaining most of the time. Or you're
getting rich off of it.
And well, some, yeah. The salaries are inflated. A lot of union leaders have inflated salaries. It's ridiculous. They should make the same amount of money that the people they represent make. Then they'd be a lot tougher in negotiations, at least for a while. But also there's this thing with some union leaders, this is very few, but some, it has an effect, they're really kind of angling for a job with management, you know? Management will use a union leader to first fool people, put them in HR or something, and then, you know, use their talents, quote unquote, which is goes from organizing to manipulation and coercion, you know, as management. There's union leaders that are so demoralized because they don't have the socialist vision or socialist analysis, so they don't understand why the unions are so weak. They don't understand why they need union democracy. They don't understand why they need an active membership, right? So they just do the concessionary bargaining till they got almost nothing left. They say, we did the best we could. It's not our fault. Click. That click is the lights shutting off in the union office. They're the last ones out the door to a cushy retirement. You know what I mean? A lot of unions have, in recent decades, last couple decades, they've merged. A lot of unions that say, if you went back and looked at a list of unions from the 80s or 90s, a lot of those unions have disappeared from that list. It's not because the union totally disappeared the way I just described. It's because they merged with another union. Sorry. Yep. They may have disappeared. Sorry, I have a cold. Or they may have or likely they merged with another union. And that's a good deal for the union leaders. They either get a a sort of severance pay, or they continue, you know, in a without even getting elected to a new position in the leadership. You know, so there's a lot wrong with the labor movement, which we're starting to get into. But it's always better to be in a union than not to be in a union, because it can change. And every once in a while, a union or a union leader will rediscover. Socialism, you know, or like, oh yeah, you need an active membership to win anything.
Well, take that book and dust it off. The
How about that?
Oh, let me read. Wow, what was that? How many chapters does that thing have anyway?
A lot.
It's huge.
Yeah, you don't have to. People don't have to understand all of it. You can get a lot out of it reading it. Like I read it when I was
just the introduction was like a book.
Yeah, I read volume one of Capital when I was like 17 or 18, and I was working this horrible job and in a factory job I've talked about.
What was your impression?
I loved it, and I felt like I understood all of it. And then later I reread it again more carefully, and I realized I did not understand all of it. But the parts I did understand were enough to keep me propelling me through the book, and because there are easy parts too, and it's just written. Also, you have to be able to read archaic language. But you know, a lot of people have written. Now, I'm sorry, I'm not archaic, but language from an earlier century. But a lot of people have, interpreted archaic, older.
Oh, older. Yeah, okay.
Like from the 1800s language instead
like
of
old English,
even the translations, but. Not old English, not that bad, but, you know, just phrases we're not familiar with. But then, you know what? A lot of people have also translated it, and
both
literally, but also, like literal translation into more contemporary language, but also they've taken the concepts and they've, you know, written about them in a clearer way. So there's plenty of ways to, angles to understand that, you know, basic works of Marxism. Doesn't have to be, go back and read all the originals. Doesn't hurt if you can. If you want to try that, it doesn't hurt. But anyway, so what was the original point before we got off on the union? Labor movement.
Well, I started with that whole, you know, happy holidays, Local 12, and then that secretary
business unionism. Business agent. Yeah, why? Yeah,
why is he even claiming that?
Why? Yeah, exactly. And then they wonder, and then people start using the term union boss, which is union bosses, which is incorrect, but. I can see why they might think that sometimes because of the stuff like that. You know, the union will mimic a lot of the building trades unions. They think that the only way they can survive is by convincing corporations, you know, contractors to give them jobs, and so they try to do that by saying we'll be the best workers for you, blah blah. We have the training and all that. Well. For years now, decades, hundreds, or even 100 years or more, the contractor's answer to that is we'll develop our own training, you know? And where they can get away with it, they will then just tell the union to screw off. What the building trades unions need to understand is that you can make your living through public works projects. You know, there's plenty to be done with housing and infrastructure and transportation and all that, but that's going to mean creating being part of a movement that goes way to the left of Democrats. It's going to have to be a workers' party that can fight and win those things. Democrats win them piecemeal here or there, but at the same time they promote private. I mean, when's the last time you heard about any real public housing being built? Housing built by, you know, owned by the city. It gets refurbished sometimes. But when you see new public housing, they wonder why the rents keep going up. Rents always go up under capitalism. Housing has been a crap show under capitalism forever. Except when in a certain country, and there was a time where this happened in the U.S. to a certain extent, the workers get strong enough to demand decent housing. So, for example, the Second International, the Socialist Party in Germany, got strong enough in the 1800s, one of the strongest socialist parties in the world, got strong enough in the late 1800s or 1900s to get social housing built all around that country. In Britain, Labour Party after World War II got strong enough and still had a lot of socialist ideas in it, that it built enormous public housing projects in the post-World War II period. In the United States, protest movements and stuff, including the civil rights movement and also in the 60s and 70s, forced public housing to be built. So there were times where then all of a sudden, when you think about like Boston in the 70s, oh yeah, I could afford to live here, you know. I knew people, I started working here in the 80s, I worked with workers who was like, yeah, I used to have an apartment on, you know, and they'd mention some street in Back Bay, and you'd be like, what? I used to have a apartment on Marlboro Ave or something, you know, where only the rich people
Beacon
live.
Beacon Hill.
Yeah, exactly. I used to have an apartment on Beacon Hill. Well, that all disappeared in the 80s and 90s. And there's a direct correlation to the fact that that's when they started to tear down public housing, stop building it, you know, et cetera. It's that simple. Doesn't mean it's a solution. Because public housing under capitalism, all they have to do is yank the funding from it, and all of a sudden it becomes horrible. It doesn't get repaired. There's no security.
Yeah,
they just destroy public housing in a second by just defunding it.
It's like South Bronx, where I went this the Thanksgiving weekend. Yeah, no funding.
Yeah,
they live. You walk into those projects, it's like, you know, being caged up. It's like like a jail cell.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever been in South Bronx.
No, but I've been to a project.
That whole area where all the buildings look alike, kind of like.
I've been through it, but what I would maybe compare it to a little bit is Harlem. I stayed in a housing project in Harlem one time, and the apartments themselves were really good. They were big, and they were good. But yeah, you had to go through some enormous security that was kind of creepy. You know, like the revolving, those little gates, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And the guards there and all that. But, you know, people live there, get to know the guard. It's not a big deal, but it's still kind of creepy. But even that housing was like, people were talking about the gentrifying of Harlem. This was in the 90s, right? I don't know if that place still exists that I stayed in. I stayed in Britain. I stayed in what they call council housing, public housing in the 80s in Liverpool. And it was really nice, actually. Again, big apartments. It was just before, it was the 84, 85 time period. And the drug epidemic hadn't hit yet. And I was like, this is the best public housing I've stayed in anywhere. Much nicer than the U.S. For the most part. There's nice hot public housing in the U.S. still. There was. But it's, you know, they just defunded a lot and ruined it. But I was really impressed with it. And then, of course, you had, like, that movie, let's say, Trainspotting in the 90s, right? That movie, Trainspotting, where a lot of those council houses turned into... That took place in Glasgow, I think, not Liverpool. The same thing in Liverpool. They defunded under the Thatcher years, you know? And they and it quickly turned into really poverty-stricken council housing, you know? In France, you know how you hear about, like, les banlieues, the suburbs...
Mm-hmm.
Where a lot of the immigrant population lives, Arab immigrants, African immigrants, and so on. That used to be in the 50s and 60s. It used to be mostly white workers. Immigration wasn't enough, but it was diverse also.
Suburbs?
Yes.
Of France?
Yeah. In the big apartment blocks, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Suburbs of Paris, I'm talking about. That's mainly what that refers to. It could be other cities as well. So, again, I didn't stay in any apartments there, but I saw them. Right, like I went out to the suburbs when I was traveling in France in 1983, and I was impressed at how safe it was. I said, "Well, this is much safer than like the South Bronx, right?
Bronx, yeah.
Much safer than other neighborhoods I've been in the U.S. Much safer than South Boston, even." And I was like, "Okay," I took note of that. I went back in the 90s for a visit, went out to the same area, not exact same area, but the same general area, and I got out of the subway, and it was like people were, you know, hanging out. Clearly affected by drugs, clearly angry, mean, menacing people staring you down, you know, all that kind of stuff going on in any neighborhood that's kind of really dangerous. And it was just, wow, what a difference, you know? And I found out why. Because in the 80s, I think it was, might have been the 90s, the government basically offered subsidies to people that lived in those housing, the big tall buildings, you know, the council flats, as they call them in Britain, like I said, they offered them mortgage subsidies to go out to further out in the burbs, in the suburbs, or to other new places that they were building. They were doing house building, in other words. They were building new, in this case, it wasn't so much public housing, which was unfortunate, but it was more
private,
but low. Well, okay, I don't know who built it. Might have been the state, it might have been private, but whoever built it, they were giving these people, the working class people, enormous subsidies to go out and move out there to better conditions. And people snapped it up. It was mostly white workers snapping it up at that point in time. So the immigration, again, not totally, but that was a big point of it. So you could go to some places in France and you could find suburbs. Some look just like a suburb of the United States, which was kind of creepy, kind of weird.